Why not we start the meeting? We don't have a quorum yet, but we can get started. And today we're going to have an overview from the Department of Human Services on managed care and waivered services. And I have a couple of announcements. If you have stuff left over from last year in your folder, why don't you take it out and we'll dispose of it for you. And secondly, there's information in your folders which you need to keep on the bonding projects where we will be dealing with
next week
or 2 weeks from now. So, who's here from the Department of Human Services? Why don't you come on down, as they say. Well, if you'd please identify yourself for the tape so that we can, when we do the minutes, we'll know who's talking.
My name is Karen Pete. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services in the managed care area.
I'm Alex Bartolik. I'm the Director of Disability Services in the Continuing Care Administration in the Department of Human Services.
I'm Dean Wood. I'm with the Youth and Adult Services Division, the Department of Human Services.
And I can't write and talk at the same time. Mr. Chairman, do you have a preference on the order in which we...
I know, whatever the department wants to do. So
okay.
Go right ahead.
We'll start with managed care then, Mr. Chairman and members. In your packet, you have a short overview, contains a few slides, and a brief narrative about managed care. My understanding, though, is that what you wanted to talk about was, in general, growth in the program, what we spend, and something on how the rates are set.
Yes.
So that's what I intended to address today. At this time, the Department of Human Services has contracts with 10 managed care organizations. 6 of them are HMOs, 4 are county-based purchasing groups. You have a list of the participating plans in your packet. We currently serve about 430,000 people through managed care contracts. Most of them are what we would call in our families and children's contracts. That includes medical assistance eligible adults and children, pregnant women, Minnesota Care families and children, and also GAMC. And included in the GAMC and Minnesota Care group is the group of people that came in through the GAMC door and were moved by a transitional Minnesota Care to the Minnesota Care program. In addition, we do have a number of seniors, about 35,000 seniors, that are enrolled in our Minnesota Senior Health Option, and another few thousand seniors that are still enrolled in the Minnesota Senior Care, which is our Minnesota Senior Care and Senior Care Plus, which is our basic program for seniors that does not include coordination with, it includes coordination with Medicare, but it doesn't mix the two benefit sets. We have two programs for people with disabilities that allow people, most people who are disabled under the age of 65 are not required to enroll in managed care programs, but we do have two programs that allow people with disabilities to voluntarily enroll in managed care. Those are the Minnesota Disability Health Option and Special Needs Basic Care. And we have about 1,500 people enrolled in those two programs right now. Most of them are in NIMBY, which is a small program that includes both Medicare and Medicaid and also the waiver services. And it serves slightly less than 1,000 people in a limited geographic area. Special needs basic care is offered statewide. We have 628 members as of January 1st, and 618 of those members are with one plan, and the remaining 10 are distributed among other plans. In your packet, there is a list of links that will let you go onto the DHS website and look at which health plans have contracts in which counties. The number of people that we serve in managed care has been pretty stable over the last about 5 years. We've been sitting at about 425,000 to 430,000 people. If you look at the slide that is on page 6 of the managed care handout, you can see that there's been a decrease in the DAMC population as some of those people have moved to Minnesota's transitional Minnesota care. Medical assistance is increasing slightly. We don't know whether that's a shift from people who formerly got care through Minnesota care. Probably that includes some of those people. Minnesota care overall is down somewhat, even with the shift of about 10,000 people on general assistance medical care to Minnesota care. There still is a decrease in Minnesota care, and we are not able to say at this point how much of that has to do with people who formerly were enrolled in Minnesota care but would still have been eligible for medical assistance. Those people may be making the decision to enroll in medical assistance because there is no premium, or fewer kinds of cost sharing. Or it may be that generally with the economic situation that we're in right now, people are making a choice between gasoline for their cars and mortgage payments and rent payments, and whether or not to sign up for the Minnesota Care Program even though it's comparatively affordable. I think a notable change in how the people are distributed in our programs is on MPHIL. Minnesota Senior Health Options has been that integrated Medicare and Medicaid product that we have offered for a number of years. And you can see that the program was fairly small in 2003 and 2004 and 5. What really propelled the Minnesota Senior Health Option program to the fore, I think, was the advent of Medicare Part D. And for people to continue to get their medications through the same health plan where they formerly got it on medical assistance, they needed to enroll in MSO in order to get all of that integrated. Otherwise, they would have had to choose a separate, disconnected medication program beginning in January of 2006. And so you can see the big difference in January 2005, where we were still sitting right around 5,000 or 6,000 members, to January of 2006, where the roll swelled to 33,000 for seniors enrolled in MSO. And that trend has continued. Basically, most seniors who are enrolled in managed care through the state public programs do sign up for the MSO program. I gave you the MINDO numbers that they're running a couple of hundred higher this year in January of 2008. The other, as I mentioned, the other 600 people that are enrolled in, who are disabled that are enrolled in managed care programs are enrolled through special needs basic care. And I've traveled fast and assumed a certain amount of familiarity with the programs. Let me just ask members if you'd like me to give you a little more of a summary of what's covered in any of the programs.
I would like you to do that.
Okay. All right. basically under managed care, and let me start with the families and children context, because that is perhaps the sort of core structure that we have. And we call the program TMAP because that's what the original waiver was named back in the 1980s. It was the prepaid medical assistance program. And since that time, at that time, we included general assistance medical care in the program as a strategy for contracting, and have, by federal fiat, essentially, also included the Minnesota Care enrollees in that contract, because that's the way our waiver is structured. When we started the program as a demonstration project, we had contracts in three counties, which included only a portion of the Hennepin County members, also Dakota County and Itasca County. And since that time, we've moved so that we have contracts available in 87 counties to cover people with medical who are eligible for medical assistance, general assistance, medical care, and Minnesota care. The last four counties that have not had medical assistance managed care will begin enrollment on March 1st of this year. And so we will be statewide for families and children in managed care beginning March 1st. Under contract with the Department of Human Services, the health plans cover a defined set of benefits, which is essentially all of the basic health care services that would otherwise be provided in fee-for-service. They cover doctor visits, hospitalization, including inpatient and outpatient hospital services, mental health services, chemical dependency services, therapies, a certain amount of home care services, not the services that would be covered under the waiver, but basic home care like home health nurse or home health aide, supervisory nursing for home health care services, and PCA services. We have, over the years, increased the numbers of services that are included in managed care. In this current contract, we completed the addition of the adult rehab mental health services, which had previously to last year been handled on a fee-for-service basis, and we are now integrating those services into the contract, effective January 2008. So all of the adult mental rehab services have moved over. And beginning in July, we'll be adding the two remaining chemical health services that had been left out on fee-for-service prior to this time. Extended care and halfway house have been handled on a fee-for-service basis, and due to changes in the licensing rule and the assessment process, we'll be integrating all of the treatments services for chemical health into the managed care contract, both for families and children, seniors, people with disabilities, the whole, across the system. We're trying to make our contracts consistent in what benefits they cover.
Representative Loeffler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pete, and with the integration of these mental health benefits, will we also be including then costs of state hospital and SOC services within that, if someone's committed to services?
Right now, Representative Loeffler, right now, managed care plans are responsible for state hospital services if they approve the service or if the service is court ordered. So for state hospital admission, so to the regional treatment center or the community programs, those would be covered. For state-operated community services, there are some payments. I'm trying to think. Sometimes there are placements of children that are covered by health plans. Right now, children's residential treatment services are not included in health plan contracts. We're working with through the groups that are convened to implement the governor's mental health initiative to find the best way to address children's mental health residential services. The issue there is that there are two sources of payment. The county pays for essentially the residential portion of that service, and medical assistance pays the treatment costs. And so we're working to have the best method so that we don't have a disconnect between the residential and the treatment services. We had anticipated that we would include that service beginning January 2009, but we're still in the process of working out the details.
Thank you.
Continue.
Okay, I'm completely distracted.
We have Representative Bunn has a question.
Yes. While we're still, thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Keats, while we're still on this topic, you mentioned in the latter part of your comments about by effective 2008, including adult rehab, mental health, and then by July, adding chemical health, extended stay, halfway house, etc. I have heard, I've met with my county social service people several times over this interim, and also for some email from other ones connected with those programs. A couple of comments that connect to this. I know we heard much last session when we were talking about improving mental health, integrating physical health and mental health in a more integrated system, and there are some, obviously, some positive things associated with that. On the other hand, I would want two questions. One is, with these new changes in this direction, have you already planned evaluative procedures and studies to evaluate whether or not, in fact, this improves mental or physical health for folks, or improves the efficiency of delivery of services over what we've already had in place when these changes occur? So what kind of evaluation of these changes is going to occur? And secondly, this may be more of a comment and for our committee as a whole, these changes, I would expect, are in some way shifting monies that currently go to counties outside the county purchasing contracts, but go to counties for chemical dependency, mental health, coordination, other kind of coordination of services to these increases in these packages to managed care, because now those services can be coordinated from that area. So we're shifting who's kind of bottom line accountable and where the coordination will occur, and so I'm concerned about whether that's going to work well and how we'll know that. But I'm also concerned about our county budget, because this shift is occurring at a time when counties have been experiencing for years in a row now significant cuts, and also just recently this big hit from the federal government. And so I'm concerned about this transition as well in terms of more funds being moved from counties to this initiative in this source. So anything you have to comment in response to that, I'd appreciate hearing as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative. To your first question, where we will put our effort in the evaluation, particularly around the integration of mental health and physical health, will have to do with the implementation of the governor's mental health initiative, the Preferred Integrated Network. There are stakeholders groups right now that are meeting to provide input to the department on what should be included in the RFP, and sort of by natural progression, how that should be addressed in contract. And there's also a group that's meeting to talk about the evaluation and what is it that we want to see, how will we evaluate the integration of those services. And there's another group that is meeting on the question of targeted mental health case management. Mm-hmm. You've correctly noted that we are shifting where the responsibility for coordination of these services is where's the responsibility? Who has the C to it responsibility? And so there is a group that is meeting to provide input on the transfer of case management services. What duties remain with the county? What duties would transfer to the managed care organization? I think there is an expectation, to a large extent based on patterns that we've seen in working with seniors programs, that health plans will be likely to contract with counties for some of that case management service. It is well understood that there's a resource there that is skilled in delivering that kind of service, and it will, I think, perhaps there be some focus on increasing the coordination between the services that have sort of been traditionally provided by counties, with more emphasis on increasing the coordination of the physical health side. Mm-hmm. One of the concerns, and I don't want to stray too far, but one of the concerns, particularly for people with severe, significant mental health issues, is that they tend to die at younger ages, and it is not due to suicide. It's often due to things like untreated chronic diabetes, mm-hmm. Untreated asthma, hypertension, other kinds of services, and so that is an area that we know that we have to focus on in evaluation.
Representative Loffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the key to that issue as you're developing your evaluation model, I would really like to encourage it to go far beyond just the integration of physical and mental health. And for the people in the system, I hope that you're going to be looking more broadly to what's happening to this population. I just recently looked at some statistics, and it's like the highest amount of dropping in and out of medical assistance or general assistance medical care, any of these health programs, is by people with mental health and chemical dependency challenges. And as a result, they have real breaks in continuity of care. And if you're only measuring the people in the system and you're not looking at whether or not more people are dropping off, whether or not more people are losing housing or you know, the other support services that stabilize their lives, you won't be bringing us back as much information as I hope we have about this whole major new initiative on mental health. And so I hope we're looking at the total person and the total impact on their lives, not just what happens to them within that new contracted system.
Representative Loffler, thank you. That's a valid point, and continuity of enrollment is also something that's on the list of things to be evaluated. The idea that assistance can be provided to help people maintain eligibility for the kinds of programs that allow them access to services is certainly something that we're aware of and interested in evaluating. Can I leave that topic and go on? I talked about the range of services that are covered for families and children. Just a side comment, there are cost-sharing requirements for those populations. Your eligibility would determine what cost-sharing requirements you have. If you are a Minnesota Care individual, you would have the required Minnesota Care co-payments if you are eligible to. For instance, a pregnant woman who is eligible for medical assistance or Minnesota Care does not have the same co-payments. So tracks consistently with how the programs were developed. For the other large population that we have enrolled is seniors, people who are 65 and older. Most seniors in Minnesota are required to enroll in managed care plans. The few who aren't are those who have, for the most part, who have a non-institutional spend down. We do allow some people with non-institutional spend downs to voluntarily enroll in Minnesota Senior Health Options. But for the most part, if you're just enrolling in Minnesota Senior Care or Minnesota Senior Care Plus, and you have a non-institutional spend down, you would not be required to enroll. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, most seniors are required to enroll. The plans cover the same set of benefits, including the changes to the mental health and chemical dependency benefits. They would also be required to cover a certain number of days of nursing facility care, with the idea that we wanted to be sure that there was no incentive for plans to discharge a person to a nursing home because they didn't have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. So the number of days of institutional care that health plans have to cover is determined by whether you're enrolled in MSO or Minnesota Senior Care. For Minnesota Senior Care Plus, which will be our standard program for seniors, beginning in 2009. The plan covers all of those same basic health care services and the elderly waiver services. So if an individual is eligible for home and community-based services through the elderly waiver, the health plan would be responsible for that coverage. We have that now available in 80 counties, and we will be procuring for the 7-county metro area with an RFP that's due to go out late this month or early next month to select plans to provide Minnesota Senior Care Plus. We believe that the way the statute's written requires us to re-procure that instead of simply making it a contract change. So the basic care is all of the basic care for adults plus some long-term care through nursing facility. Minnesota Senior Care Plus includes the home and community-based services through the elderly waiver. And then the difference between that and Minnesota Senior Health Option, or MSO, is that MSO includes Medicare or connects to the Medicare package in a very direct way. The health plans that contract with us for MSO are special needs plans through Medicare. They have a contract with CMS for the Medicare services for individuals who are dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, and then they contract with the Department of Human Services for Medicaid services and meld those two benefits. So there's a high degree of coordination. Plans are required on the Medicaid side to have, and on the Medicare side, to provide for care coordination. And there's a model that's been developed that centers around a care coordinator who essentially connects the long-term care services, the home and community-based services, and the primary care and acute care services. And they have a great deal of flexibility to do things to prevent disruption to care, the idea being that if there is it's Friday afternoon in the nursing home and under ordinary circumstances Margaret would be at risk of being placed in the hospital because she has pneumonia, under MSO the care coordinator has flexibility to provide some additional staff to the nursing home so that the hypothetical Margaret doesn't have to be moved, so that she can stay in place, because we know that it's very disruptive to seniors to be moved in and out of hospitals, and sometimes that will cause as much bad effect on their health as, you know, whatever the condition is. So having the flexibility to bring resources and use them in different ways in the community is one of the primary benefits that we get out of the MSO program.
Yeah, Ms. Pete, are the care managers or are those nurses?
Care managers, health plans have different kinds of models. There are a number of models where health plans contract with care managers who are nurses. Some of them are clinic-based. Some of them are arrangements with care coordination systems, such as Evercare. There are also an increasing number of models where health plans have contracts with the same folks that used to provide elderly waiver case management in the counties to provide some care coordination and care management. So there are a range of models that are out there. It's not, and one of the things that I found in my conversations with county directors is that the kinds of services that health plans are asking for are many of the same services that were provided in case management, but there are also additional kinds of things, and it tends to be more around linking to the healthcare system. And some folks have said that they feel that it's a benefit to the members and to the case managers in that situation.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Pete, as we evolve towards asking managed care to kind of serve more challenging populations with different sorts of needs. I mean, we have for the last few decades, probably since the 70s, medicated much of our social services in order to gain the 50% federal dollars. which was seen as a way to increase supportive services in the community for people's more social service, human service sort of needs. And as we bring in people with disabilities, seniors who are not yet medically complicated, but maybe just going down that route of frailty and needing more support, when we're bringing in people with a variety of mental health challenges, I'm wondering what you're doing to assist the health plans in seeing themselves in a whole different role and applying maybe a different standard. I don't have any doubt about the health plan's abilities to do medical case management and to coordinate medical care for the best health care outcomes. I do have some doubts yet about their abilities to meet the social service needs of people in the community, integrating them with other community resources, the types of things that I think counties have excelled at in the past, and the standard of medical necessity, which has always been what's guided, you know, use of resources within the managed care system, is not really necessarily the appropriate question to ask when you're talking about these support services for people who are living in the community who need social service needs. And, it's intervening with landlords when there's housing disputes so someone doesn't get evicted. I mean, that's not a medical necessity, but it's a necessity to assist a person who's struggling with a variety of challenges to have a stable life. And I'm just wondering, are you putting things in the contract? Are you doing requiring in-service training? What are you doing to sort of evolve the model and the definition of what's the necessary service, what's the range of services that are to be expected on the non-healthcare sort of side, so that we continue to have that safety net of support for this population?
Representative Huntley, the process is evolving in a number of ways. On the one hand, I think that DHS can confess to and probably be backed up by the health plans, to a fairly cavalier attitude in adding additional services and saying to health plans, you figure this out. As we have moved to those services that are less like the strictly medical model and those that are commonly provided in the commercial market, and I would take as case in point the addition of the adult mental health rehab services, we have offered and health plans have asked for a better process for transition, and so we, as we've transitioned each of those services into the health plans, we've had a series of meetings between DHS policy staff and the provider community, as well as the health plans, to talk about how this process should transition, how should it be coordinated, what's different about this service to what you're used to doing, and then we've had follow-up meetings to see how the implementation has gone and have, sort of tracked those very closely to be sure that there's a smooth transition for people. In addition, the health plans have been direct and appropriately assertive about requesting additional training for their staff. They're saying to us, we want the people who will take the phone calls about the service to understand what it is that's being offered and how each of these new services is used, because otherwise they're going to revert to what is standard. And so we want them to have special training from DHS to understand how these services work and how they should be implemented. And so that's a change that we made in moving along the adult mental health rehab services. And it's a model that we would adopt as we implement the chemical health services, for example. And I expect that we would have additional transition of that kind as we move forward with other non-traditional services or less traditional services. I've noted that we are getting input on case management, and I think that there will be similar kinds of conversations going the other way from DHS to health plans as we move that forward. As far as the coordination with social services, health plans have learned a great deal as they've implemented the MSO program, and they did it on a small scale initially. Even for seniors, you know, there are seniors where it makes a big difference if the rent is paid, if there's an air conditioner in the apartment. There are a whole variety of those things where they're understanding that there are things that are outside of drugs that are prescribed or things that interactions that happen during a clinic visit or at the hospital that will determine a great deal about the ongoing health of their member on a daily basis and preserving them in place in their home. And so we expect that those lessons will also be part of the process of transitioning to these newer services to serve the new population. Okay. So I think I've talked about the families and children and seniors. Did I get to disabilities? I've been sort of led there. Let me just say briefly, Minnesota Disability Health Option covers people who have physical disabilities and a few people with developmental disabilities and includes all of the basic health care services that are covered under medical assistance, and it includes the services from the appropriate home and community-based waivers for those populations. It also includes a certain number of days of nursing home care. We do have a specific limitation in statute and are not expanding that program. We're limited until 2009 to do any expansion with that. And there's also a moratorium on the federal side for expansion of special need plans on the Medicare side. So we're effectively maintaining the status quo with that program right now, and won't be doing any expansion until we're free to do so. Special needs basic care is the last program that we have contracted for people with disabilities. This is a pared down basic benefit set, if you will. It includes most of the basic health care services, including acute care, inpatient, and outpatient hospitalization services. What it does not include is PCA, the nurse supervision of PCA, or the home and community-based waivers. And the reason for that is that we've been sort of skirting that issue here in the last several minutes. For people with disabilities, oftentimes those services like PCA are a lot about your physical well-being, but they're also a lot about having a life, if you will, as one advocate put it to me. And there really was unwillingness or reservation. I would characterize it as unwillingness, and perhaps appropriately so. I'm part of the advocacy community to move too fast in that direction by putting those services into the health plan's responsibility. So for the waiver services and the PCA and the supervision of the PCA services for the special needs basic care, those would continue to be available on a fee-for-service basis. So if you're getting case management through a particular county agency, you will continue to get your case management through that agency. And the health plan is still responsible for coordinating the rest of the health care with whatever's going on there. In terms of social services or other PCA-type services or waiver services that aren't covered in the contract. But they're not responsible for arranging for and paying for those services. I know that you wanted to know what goes on with payments. How much do we spend? We do spend a great deal of money on these programs. I put in a chart that just lays out in millions of dollars across a number of years what we spend on capitation payments. These numbers would include that amount of the contract that is withheld and then paid back if the health plan meets certain performance standards. For example, in 2007, we had a number of performance requirements that the health plans had to meet, in order to earn their withhold back. The numbers that are, let me say 2006, because that'll make my example come out right. For 2006, the health plans had a number of requirements they had to meet. All of the health plans that met those requirements got the payments in July of 2000 or prior to July of 2007 for that withhold. And so those withhold dollars would be included in this capitation amount that I've given you here. There are additionally some services where we, or some areas where we have offered performance incentives for health plans. Those dollars are not included in here. I wasn't able to break those out and get them into the chart in time for this meeting.
Were there any health plans that did not get their withhold back?
For 2006, yes, there were. And the big issues were whether they met the requirements for, the biggest issue for plans was whether they met the requirements for less screening. That was the snag that most of them had.
Could you explain that registry?
Mr. Chairman, I will try. Vicki Kuhners is much better at this than I am. Health plans have a certain amount or certain performance levels that they've achieved on screening children for lead. We want them to get to a point where they're screening, I believe, and this is where my brain disconnects. I believe we want them to get 80% of their children screened in a timely manner. We use a measure for the withhold of increment of the gap, I believe, or is that the withhold? Yeah, okay. I'm looking at the people who have to do this. So if I am at 75% and the target is 80%, I need to get 10% of the gap. So I'm 5% of my, I have, you know, just 5% of kids that I need to screen, and that's my target for a year. If I miss that, then I don't get my withhold for that. And the withhold on lead is one amount to 20% of the withheld amount, which amounts to 1% of the capitation. It can translate to a surprisingly large amount of money for health plans that have very large enrollment. So it's a significant withhold. If you need details, chapter and verse, I'd have to go back and look them up rather than misspeak in public.
How many plans did not get the withhold?
I can't remember. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I will get that back to you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Ms. Pete, this is an area of real interest to me at the time the data want, but I really do think we need to look at how we're doing quality improvement, and I was discouraged when we sought this chart pull audit, performance audits of the health plans, which focused on particular issues and really showed dramatic differences, and I think really resulted in a real feedback that was plan-specific. And I'm hearing, I don't know if this is true, and you can get us more information on exactly what those gaps are, what the withholds are, and what the gaps are, and what the performance standards are, but I've heard that on some of the measures that you use, that like if the goal was 80%, we're tolerating people being at 40 or 50%, and they have to go up, you know, 10% towards that goal, but we're not close. And what I still keep in my mind, and what's been haunting me ever since the budget was presented last year, was a measure that off the top of my head, it was in the budget book, but it was for children under 18 months of age in TMAP, and it was less than half, as I recall, or near half, that were up to date on their well-child checkups, immunizations, et cetera. And that, to me, for, you know, new moms with young children, with the efficacy of those well-child visits and inoculations being so critical, to have that low a performance after 20-plus years of the system just feels to me like we're just not pushing that performance quality initiative in the right way. And I really want to explore with you and your staff ways that we can start to move it forward, because we're investing a tremendous amount of money in these families. And, you know, the numbers are tremendous. And I think we ought to be able to see, even with this challenging a population, that kind of result being improved. And I look at what public health has done with tiny amounts of money across all populations and counties, and I can't believe that we can't start seeing some faster progress on some of these quality indicators. And so I hope you'll be open to working with us. But I think the first step is if we could get the what's the measures and the withholds, what's the current performance data, what you're measuring, I think we can at least start to that discussion. And I don't know that it's not anyone's desire. I just don't think we're measuring the right things. And, you know, what gets measured gets done. I just think we have a lot farther to go.
Chairman, Representative, thank you. we would certainly be open to a discussion. I apologize if I realized I was going to be asked those questions. I have put them in my folder this morning and brought them along. We can get to the information about specifically what measures are used for the withhold. They are things that are within the health plan's control. We also have, as I mentioned, areas of incentive. Because of the way that we set the rates, if a health plan makes a significant effort in order to change a measure such as lead screening or mammograms or whatever, it takes a while for us to catch up with any big increase in service delivery through the way that we set the rates, and therefore we have the incentive payments. Health plans do get paid for increases on the incentive, and they are targeted around issues that it's clear are important to legislative members, community members, policy people at the Department of Human Services. So we've tried to target our measures to those things that are significant and have weight. We're also very closely tied to the acute care measures from the governor's acute care initiative. So we'd be happy to share those with you and be happy to work with you on strategies. One thing I can say about the population, though, is that it's not the same population. It is the same population, but it's not the same people. And so, to some extent, whether we're talking Medicaid fee-for-service or Medicaid managed care, every year as the members that we serve change, we're starting the process over with new people. But maybe there's a way to structure the program so that the delivery is more effective. We're open to discussing that.
Representative Murphy had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions come from the document that I have before me dealing with rate development, and if Ms. Peed would like to finish her testimony on the section and then I can ask questions, that's fine.
Well, I was hoping that we could move to rate development. I warned my colleagues that if they wanted to talk today, they should go first. So, I apologize.
Representative Abler, you had a question?
If we're talking about rates, maybe, are we doing rates next? Is that what you said?
That was my...
Well, then maybe I'll listen to that, and my questions are about rates. So thank you.
I've been asked to talk a little bit about how it is that we set the rates for managed care. In the early days, we used to go back to the fee-for-service population and say, what have we spent on this population, what do we expect to spend, and we used that experience to set the rates. And when we did that, the number of people that were enrolled in managed care was smaller than the number of comparable people on fee-for-service. So we had a very large fee-for-service population, a large base of experience to use in setting the rates. As we've moved most of the families and children into managed care, we no longer have that fee-for-service experience. Typically, we have overall 70% of the Minnesota healthcare program's enrollees are enrolled in managed care programs. For families and children, they have a few months of fee-for-service experience, perhaps. It may be the Medicaid retroactive payment that pays for the events that led them to believe that they needed to come down to the county and apply for assistance. It may or may not be consistent with their ongoing health care needs. And it's a very small proportion of the experience. The bulk of the people who are on our fee-for-service programs are people who have significant disabilities, either through mental health, chemical dependency, developmental disability, or physical disability. And they're not the same as the people that we enroll in the PMAP program. So we've, over the number of years, we have shifted to the use of managed care experience to set our rates. We use, one of the problems that we had with using a short period of time, like 1 year, is that it tends to make the rates very volatile. If you have a big increase in costs 1 year, then the rates go up. And then if the next year you have a decrease, then you need to bring the rates down. And so it makes it difficult both for the state and for the plans to budget when the rates are moving, having big shifts. And so we've gone to a process of using a three-year base. For the 2008 rates, we set the rates based on a three-year period, 2003 through 2006. And what we do is we look at what was the plan's experience, what did we target for them. We target what I refer to in my notes as a modest contribution to surplus. It's over and above what it costs you to operate the program, what do you get to put away for your reserves against a rainy health care day, in essence. So if the population turns out to be sicker, or you have some kind of a crisis with the population, more newborns with high critical needs or something, then would have been reflected in the prior experience, so that you have something in your reserve to pay for those services. We've tried to target that contribution to reserve well below 2%. We used to say kind of the 1-3% rate area. All of the organizations that we contract with, whether they're HMOs or county-based purchasing groups, are nonprofits. They're not out there to make a profit. They are there to serve the population and to put away enough funds so that they can serve those populations in a future year if the payment rates aren't adequate or if the health risk changes faster than we account for in our rate setting. So we've targeted that contribution to reserves to be around 1% or 2% in the last several years, and I noticed I have similar slides. I noticed in the Council of Health Plans that they have a slide that shows how closely we approximated, how much over the target amount we were with our rates. And over the last several years, by paying close attention to the data, we've managed to make our targeted reserve, the amounts that the health plans are targeted to make, much closer to what we had planned. The way that we go about doing that is to take the cost experience for a three-year period. We look at that's the base, and we look at did you come close to the amount that we expected you to make in the last period, or were you over or under? And so we make an adjustment to that base rate to say, okay, health plans, we thought you were going to make, let's say, 1% last year, and you made 2%. So we make an adjustment to the base rate and bring it down to what we would have expected the health plans to make. Am I making sense? it can work the other way too. If we are too eager and too close to the bone, and if in fact overall and in aggregate the health plans lose money, then we would have to look at our base and say, I guess we were off the mark here, and we'd have to adjust. Let's say that we targeted the health plans to make 1% and instead they all lost 2%. We would have to make an adjustment, in essence, to get up to where we expected the base to be. The next step that we would do in our rate setting process is to say, what has changed in terms of eligibility? You know, are we adding people? Are we subtracting people? Are we taking those GAMC people who used to be served through GAMC and sending them to Minnesota Care? And then we'd make adjustments in each of the base rates to reflect changes in eligibility. The next part of the process that we do is we look at changes in benefits. So what services are we adding? Are we going from 90 days of nursing home care for seniors to 180 days? Or are we adding adult mental health rehab services that were not previously covered under the contract, or CD services that were not previously covered under the contract? So anything that's being added in terms of a benefit or subtracted in terms of a benefit would be changed in our rate base. We'd figure out what is it going to cost us for this population to provide these adult mental health rehab services, and we would put that amount into the rate. So changes in eligibility, changes to the base based on over or under prediction, changes in eligibility, who's covered, changes in what services are covered. The next thing that we look is, and some of that information comes from you folks as the legislature. Another piece of information that comes to us from the legislature, it would be changes in payment rates. So is there a cost of living adjustment for nursing homes or home and community-based providers that are covered under our contract? Is there a 25% increase for family planning services under some circumstances? All of those changes that you approve to our fee-for-service rate structure also have to be taken into account in the managed care structure. So we make adjustments to the rate to account for all of those changes. And then in addition, and so far we're kind of on the par with what we do on the fee-for-service side. In addition, we also look at whether services are being used more frequently or less frequently. What was your experience, managed care organizations, mm-hmm. on various buckets of services, and what has changed? One of the things that we do is we look at the health plan financials to get this basic cost experience from, and to make our assessment of whether we've over or underpaid in any particular year. Another thing that we ask the health plans to do, because they file that on the 1st of April with the Commerce Department, is we ask them if there's been any change in that last period that we're looking at. So for 2008, for this current contract that we're in, they filed their 2006 results on April 1st. On April 1st, they basically had, for the last 6 months of the year, they had a very short time for any claims that, or any services that were delivered in November and December to get those providers to send in their bills. And very often we find that there can be significant changes if we look at their claims run out, we call it, 6 months later. So we ask them in June to send us a new claims run out. So that's just sort of verifying, are there changes in trends that wouldn't have been picked up in the financial report. We work with our actuary to look at all of these various numbers, and in addition we look at other kinds of measures as tests of reasonableness, if you will. Because when you're working with health plan data, it can get to be kind of a closed system. You know, they tell you what you pay, we know what we paid them, we know what they spent. Where's the incentive to not just spend some more, because DHS is going to make up the difference anyway? And so we've asked our actuaries to identify other things that we can look at as test of reasonableness. So they look at what's going on in the commercial marketplace. They look at what's going on in the Medicare marketplace in terms of trend for utilization and mostly for trend and cost changes. And they also look at other states that have similar kinds of packages that we do for Medicaid. So they look at a number of things as tests of reasonableness, and we use that to not be entirely self-referencing in looking at the health plan. So although they're, you know, they're presenting their data and we're looking at it, we're also looking at outside sources to make sure that we're not just looking at a little tiny piece of the picture and inappropriately paid for
instance. In the fee-for-service system, you process the claims within the department?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we do.
And sort of started out saying that you've moved basically all the population into the managed care system, except for a small number of people with disabilities. And so now we have no control group to look at. So that's my question is, how do we know that the plans are providing better service than we could have done if we stayed with the fee-for-service system?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. Under managed care for Medicaid, and we take those standards and apply them across our programs, there are a number of service requirements and client protections and things that go along with providing services. And so we know that health plans are required to do a number of things in terms of member services that go well beyond what's required on our fee-for-service system. If you're eligible for fee-for-service, we've really improved things now in the department because now you at least get a one-page list of the kinds of services you can expect to be required or, you know, to have access to. But really, that's a very new change. When I came to the healthcare area a number of years ago, we told you were eligible, and that was the end of the information that we gave you. If you wanted to know where could I go to get services from a doctor, we'd tell you to look in the yellow pages. Under managed care, the health plans are required to say which physicians, hospitals, clinics are in their network. And beyond that, they also have an obligation to assure that you have access to service. So one of the qualitative differences between fee-for-service and managed care is the assurance of access, because DHS holds contracts with health plans and can require them to provide access, as opposed to saying, well, you know, why don't you get the Minneapolis phone book, too, and look in those yellow pages. Maybe you'll find a doctor there. And we do, I'm being a little bit facetious, we do provide lists of providers that are enrolled with the Minnesota Healthcare Program if a person calls our recipient health desk. But that provider is under no obligation to serve the person. So there are a number of those kinds of protections, whether it's through the managed care regulation or through the Minnesota Department of Health requirements. So these health plans are among the most heavily regulated industries, I think. Maybe people sometimes balk at calling it an industry, but service sector, if you will, it is among the most, if not the most, regulated service sector that we have. People are always looking over their shoulders and say, did you do that yet? It might be me or our contract managers who are doing that. It might be someone from the Department of Health who's doing that. It might be someone from the Managed Care Ombudsman or the Mental Health and Chemical Dependency Ombudsman's Office that is looking over their shoulders to say, did you do that yet? It might be the county advocates that are outsourced in or stationed in any of the counties in Minnesota where managed care is in operation. So it's a highly regulated set of services. As far as quality, people's satisfaction, generally speaking, people are pretty satisfied. I don't know if that is a Minnesota thing or not. You know, Minnesota, in general, we're nice people. We tend to say pretty nice things about people who are quiet. But generally, most of what we see is that health plans get a B+ or better on the patient satisfaction survey. We don't even ask the people on fee-for-service if they like the services that are they're being provided. You know, we don't know. We didn't ask them. You know, there's feedback out there that suggests to me that some people are very satisfied. I've figured out, you know, it took me 12 years, but I've figured out how to navigate this system. That's good, but should it take 12 years for everybody is a question that I would have. So I think there are those kinds of qualitative differences.
Three more questions here, and then we're probably going to have to move on to waivers. Representative Aver.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions about the rates. And just a comment from the past discussion about the lead and the prevention on mentally ill people who are getting the right kind of care. Actually, if we do that right, they're actually going to cost us more money than save us money, which is a quality thing, which some of these public health initiatives actually will be spending things in terms of creating better things, which I think is a great idea. Just the point is we've got to contain costs. This, as you do your rate negotiations, you mentioned it yourself, and I don't see any incentive for the health plans to save any money and to do anything well, except that they're inclined to do it kind of naturally. If the rate is based upon last year's experience, it's all passed on. If we assure them a 1 or 2% margin, and last year was a bad year, we're going to up the rate this year. Mm-hmm. With level 3, which we talked about in the other commission and so on, I presume level 3 was what health plans do now. And so I asked them, I said, isn't this what you do now, where you actually manage the cases and do the best you can? And except for health partners who said they own clinics, the answer was no. And I was astounded. As a chiropractor, 29 years, still trying to navigate the system. I haven't got it figured out yet. I realized as I managed, it's all about money. I'm seldom managed for quality. I'm seldom given information from my carriers about what the person has had happen, and I think it's a real gap. I'm very nervous about making clinics do that as the primary, and then the total cost of care, which is a different discussion. But I think the health plan should be required to do that. And I think that this innovation, which is everywhere, gets lost in the state programs. In fee-for-service, it's my view, as you mentioned, that you just pay the bill. And the health plans give doctors' names on lists. The credentialing process for a doctor is, did you kill anybody lately? Pretty much. Give a real license and you've been disciplined. It's not, are you up on things? Do you have good quality? Are you good bedside manner? It just rules out the sex offenders and that group, which is to rule them out. But it's not a real narrowing process in terms of quality and innovation. And I think this committee, and I'm glad you're here, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't see incentives in what you told us about the plan for them to use innovative, less costly methods. I see an incentive to continue on as they continue on keeping the contact with the more expensive providers they want to have. As I talked to some of them, some hospital groups cost more, but they need them in their group, so they just pay the price, and they pass it on to us in one of the biggest growing departments in our budget. And we have the authority in this committee to do something about that as part of our cost containment, and probably will save enough money to pay for all those mentally ill folks who need the better care. I do have a question, though. Are the managed care organizations required to, do they disclose to you how they spend the money that they get, like to different groups or on different things, or just you just give them the money and then based upon their aggregate claims?
Representative Ehlert, we get an accounting of how they spend their money on, as you suggest, at an aggregate level. We get costs bucketed, if you will. So what did you spend on inpatient? What did you spend on outpatient? We need to know what you spent on mental health. You know, typically there are standard ways that health plans split information up, which is useful to us. If there's a particular concern that we have, we may ask for additional information about that. As far as, I'm not sure you mean when
I'll ask a specific question. So like, for instance, back surgery and back care is a very expensive, one of the main cost areas where I live. Do you keep track of diagnosis code, like for lumbar discs? Like how much they spent on lumbar discs, like by code. There's different codes describing different kinds of lumbar discs or strains and sprains. Do you get like how much they spent on 846.0 and 722.0, like that kind of data?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, we get a lot of information about lumbar discs, but not what is paid specifically around them. One of the issues that we have is that some agencies can collect information around healthcare cost spending, and it's protected, and plans are not exposed to whatever risk is associated with everybody knowing exactly how they pay their claims.
Thank you.
If I might finish, we are not able to provide that kind of protection, so we don't ask for the information on specific, on a service-by-service basis.
And, Mr. Chair, just occurs to me, and I don't want to take all day, but I think this is really where some of the money is. We're trying to find ways to better spend, and I think that if we could collect that, we could require that they provide us data in some secret envelope, and we can double encrypt it like Department of Health does with all the data that we're never going to get stolen. Remember that? We've been promised that only certain eyes could see it. But I think that we might discover that some health plans manage lumbar discs better than other ones per capita. And we could do risk adjustments, and we could decide to pay whatever one. I don't care who gets the business. But we might notice that one plan is especially lousy. If some of our clinics we think well of are bad at diabetic care, probably different plans are not as good at managing some of those cases, which we spend lots of money for. And we could make them do that if we wanted. I think that would be kind of entertaining. And one more question, and I'll stop. Do you know what is the trend per capita in the state-managed health plans this year, or last year?
I will get back to you with that. Okay,
thanks.
I apologize. That was a piece I didn't pick up.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Pugh, thank you for your testimony. It's been illuminating. One of the questions I've been picking at during the interim and now I think during the session is where the risk lies, who holds the financial risk. And as I listen to how the rates are set for the managed care organizations, it appears to me in the public programs that they don't carry a tremendous amount of risk in serving this population because of the way their rates are set. And so I am curious about the policy that allows for them to bank a modest contribution in their reserves, and wondering if you or others have contemplated holding that surplus in state accounts, as the taxpayers, I think, are the ones that are really holding the risk for the care for those in the public program.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I think we try to do a pretty responsible job in setting the rates. Our job is to do a good job of managing the taxpayers' money and to assure that we're not putting a lot of money out into reserves for public programs that is not going to be used to serve those populations. I would disagree. They hold a tremendous amount of risk. And if we fail to set our rates accurately, although, you know, I talked about looking to see what did we pay last year and was it under or over. If we miss in setting our rates, and if we say that they're going to be at break even or at 0.5% or 1%, if we miss and they're 1% or 2 or 3 overspent, that is all on their dime. And although I'll go back and say, okay, gosh, I'm sorry, I missed last year, I'll get you up to break even there, I don't do anything about the money that they lost last year. And there are populations and there are health plans that do lose money, and we don't go and pay them back. It's not something that we do. What we have done, though, is improve our capacity to set rates, to be more intelligent, if you will, about what data it is that we look at and what we consider, and that's how we've refined the process so that we're using the broader base period. I haven't thought particularly specific to your question about whether we should hold the reserve separately. The health department and commerce department have reserve requirements for health plans, and so I don't even know that it would be feasible. And I'm not sure that whether the bank account is located at our house or at the health plan's house makes a significant amount of difference in that instance. But I will say that there are health plans that have had spectacular losses, either when the health risk of the population changed in ways that they couldn't predict. And I did not talk to this committee about risk adjustment, but we do risk adjust our rates so that health plans that serve sicker people are paid a higher rate. That used to be a problem that we had with our health plan rate setting, and health plans that attracted sicker people got paid exactly the same as the health plan that attracted healthier people, and that wasn't fair, and health plans lost money over a period of years. So part of the picture that I've presented has been exactly that, to mitigate their risk. They hold all the risk. I won't bail them out. If I fail to set the rates correctly for 2008, I will not bail them out. I'll set it back flat when I'm looking at 2009, but I won't bail them out for 2008 if they've overstepped.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We spent a lot of time this summer in this interim trying to understand the rate setting and the negotiations that go on, and I do feel some frustration at not being able to really see the picture. And we've been talking a lot about healthcare costs, and as policymakers, we're charged with trying to address that issue, and I feel like we're continuing to do it in the blind. And I'm having a difficult time understanding sort of what is the fundamental model for how we're paying for care. And I'll just close by saying my husband owns a small business, and this is his business. We're run like this. If he were guaranteed this rate of reimbursement on his work, he wouldn't lose a night of sleep. And we talk a lot about healthcare being a market, but this feels very unmarket-like to me. And if it isn't a market, then I think we need policymakers, at least in the public programs, need to have a better understanding of what it is that we're paying for and what we're getting for that. And so I just want to close by saying that I think we need to really push ourselves there, and we don't have enough information yet. Thank you.
We're going to try to get 1, 2, 3 more questions real quick, and then we'll have a brief presentation on waivers, I think. So, Representative Hodge.
A quick question. When looking at the chart here on our overall payments when it comes to the capitation payments, when doing some further analysis, I was going into the percentage increases that were contained in this chart. And in regard to the capitation payments, our percentage increases are significantly lower than what is called for in the November forecast. So I'm wondering, the additional money in each of these programs that we spend through the general fund that doesn't include capitation payments, where is that money, and why are the percentage increases disproportionately higher than what we see here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas. The forecast is done at a different level, and particularly where we look at one of the things that one of the conversations that we've had with the department's reports and forecast division is whether there is a way to get additional data for them so that they can have a different way to reflect what should be in the managed care part of the forecast. The forecast for fee-for-service basically reflects changes in utilization, trends in utilization. It does not reflect changes in price of service, except to the extent that there are specific fee-for-service increases that are passed along by law. For the managed care plans, we also have to, because there is an obligation to assure access to services, and because we are under an obligation to be able to prove to the federal government that our rates are the term is actuarially sound, we sometimes are not exactly in line with the forecast. If we put an artificial cap on the managed care payment rates, at some point the actuary would say to us, I can't certify these rates, and then we have the issue of sending non-certified rates to CMS and we don't get our 50% on those programs where we have federal participation. So but what I would say is that we have, by and large, done a good job at being sure that the healthcare trend that goes on in the commercial side, you know, we are at or below that on a very consistent basis with medical assistance programs. So our rate of increase is not as great as it is on the commercial side. We do attend to that, and we don't go there if we don't need to. You know, we're trying to be good stewards and to manage as aggressively as we can.
Representative Bunn.
My questions are not short, so I guess as we pass, we'll move on to the next portion.
So why don't you continue, or do we want to move to waivers?
I have to work with these ladies, and I'd like to preserve some kind of a good relationship. So if the committee's amenable, I'd like to move on.
Well, you know, we have asked a lot of questions, and this is a very important, significant part of our budget. And we always need to try to be aware of whether we're getting our money's worth.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're available to come back and make additional presentations or provide additional data. I'll respond to specific requests that I've received and would be available to meet with members individually and in groups as well. Thank you.
Okay.
Ms. Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. To refresh your memory, my name is Jean Wood, and I'm the director of the Aging and Adult Services Division, and I'm here with...
And I'm Alex Bartolik with the Disability Services.
This morning we'd like to, or this afternoon, we would like to share some information that we hope is useful in the efforts to become familiar with home and community-based services that support the elderly and people with disabilities and their families. Today, my initial focus will be on the elderly waiver and the steps that we take to assure home and community-based services are available to those who need them in the future. We have provided for you some handouts. The first one is on Brown, and it provides an overview of the various waivers, including the alternative care program, the state alternative care program, and it talks about the name of the waiver, person served, eligibility, and the benefit level. On blue, we have a Medicaid cost comparison chart that shows the various waivers, the level of care, what those waivers cost, comparing them to the institutional costs that those people would incur if it were not, if they did not receive waiver services, and then the difference, which is the savings to the state for each individual who are on our various waivers. And then the last handout, and the one that I will be talking to here,
is on WISE. On one side, it talks about elderly receiving long-term care services. On the other side, are two charts on services provided for persons with disabilities. And so I would like to start talking about the elderly receiving long-term care services and what it is that we project that in the next 5 years, the caseload of elderly receiving long-term care services, both in long-term care facilities and through the elderly waiver and home care, is expected to increase from 41,200 to about 47,150, reflecting an annual growth of 4.3%. And much of this growth comes from the increases in the number of elderly needing long-term care and that are eligible for public programs. The overall average annual long-term care spending for the elderly during the same period of time is expected to increase at an annual rate of 3.6%. The average long-term care caseload for the elderly in long-term care facilities declines from 18,845 in 2007 to 16,918 in 2011. And spending for long-term care facilities declines over that same period from $741.5 million to $737.3 million in 2011. At the same time, the average long-term care caseload for the elderly waiver and home care services increases from 22,297 in 2007 to 30,196 in 2011. Spending for the waivers and home care services increases for that same period from $335.8 million in 2007 to $536.6 million in 2011. Currently, about 97% of elderly waiver clients are enrolled in managed care. This is a trend that started a number of years ago, and this percentage will continue to go up. By 2011, 64% of the elderly will be served in home and community-based settings as compared to the current 54%. This shift from 54% to 64% of the number of elderly served in the community over the next 5 years is consistent with the goals of the 2001 long-term care reform enacted by the legislature to reduce our reliance on the institutional models of care. There is a declining number of long-term care facilities and beds. The state now has 392 long-term care facilities, down from 440 in 1987, and Minnesota currently has about 34,200 beds. There also are growing numbers of programs and agencies providing home care and assisted living services to the elderly. As we look to the future, there are certain trends, drivers, and pressures on our services to the elderly, and they are the increasing number of elderly, especially those over the age of 85, who will need publicly funded long-term care services. Also, the increasing cost of providing long-term care services. This includes the rising cost of retaining long-term care workers and the cost of operating programs while managing cost growth. We also are impacted by the continued reduction in the number of family members available to provide full-time care for older relatives. We are aware that for every 1% decrease in the number of family caregivers providing care, costs public programs about $30 million a year. We are also impacted by the growing number of elderly whose income is not adequate to pay for health and long-term care costs. And starting in 2010, there will be a dramatic increase in publicly funded long-term care services as the baby boomers start to retire. We also are being impacted by increased use of more expensive home and community-based services, such as assisted living. As caseloads and costs for services increase, program strategies include implementing findings from a legislatively mandated long-term care study, now in progress, about how we can most effectively assist persons aged 65 and older in selecting long-term care services before they need publicly funded programs, avoiding more expensive services and enabling them to maintain financial self-sufficiency for as long as possible.
Ms. Wood,
mm-hmm.
on the blue sheet, you've got the elderly waiver, and then the next column is a nursing facility. That's the level of care.
That's the level of care.
That they would be in if they weren't getting the waivered services would keep them out of the nursing facility.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Starting in October 1st, 2008, all assisted living providers will be required to inform prospective residents of the availability of long-term care consultation assistance before contracting with these prospective residents, and that service will provide help to consumers in making informed decisions about the best use of their resources for necessary services. We are also working to provide timely information about long-term care services, options through long-term care consultation, senior linkage line, MinnesotaHelp.info, and providing that information in a way that elderly and their family can easily use the information prior to needing public programs and in the future including information about quality and cost. Developing through community services development grants, affordable long-term care support services across all populations and all payment sources, private and public, a robust and dependable set of home and community-based services. We are also supporting informal caregivers with timely information about services options, flexible and trusted respite services, and caregiver counseling and training, including the implementation of an evidence-based counseling model that has found to delay nursing home placement by 557 days. And lastly, we are working to expand consumer-directed community services in order to support neighbors and friends who provide long-term care services. This program purchases home and community-based services at a lower cost to the waiver program.
And Mr. Chair, members, I was going to move into the disability waivers unless you would like to ask some questions of Jean.
Any questions right now? Good. Go ahead.
Move on. Again, I'm Alex Bartolik, and I'm going to provide information about the four home and community-based waivers that support people with disabilities and their families. And they are the Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals, or the CADI waiver, which serves people with physical disabilities and increasingly people who have a mental illness. The Traumatic Brain Injury, or TBI waiver, which serves people who have a traumatic or acquired brain injury or a degenerative brain disease. The Developmental Disability waiver, or DD waiver. And the Community Alternatives for People Who Are Chronically Ill, or the CAC waiver. These waivers provide an alternative to more costly institutional care and are generally chosen by Minnesotans with disabilities as preferred services that support community living. They've enabled progress towards state policy goals for people with disabilities, and the waiver programs have allowed the state to manage growth, service quality, and access to appropriate services. I'm going to begin with the other side of the document that Jean was referencing about long-term care caseload and spending information to the section that's specific to disabilities, and it's the white document. Again, these numbers are based on the November 2007 medical assistance forecast. The table on the left of the handout reflects the average monthly caseload in long-term care for people with disabilities. This includes long-term care facilities such as nursing homes, intermediate care facilities for people with mental retardation, developmental disabilities, and hospital care, as well as the home and community-based services waiver programs. And the table on the right of the handout reflects the projected long-term care spending from fiscal year 2007 to 2011.
Starting with the average monthly caseload chart on the left, the state's increased use of home and community-based services reflects the strong preference for home and community options by people with disabilities and their families. The average monthly number of people with disabilities residing in long-term care facilities is projected to continue to decline. Over the same period, the average number of people using waivers in home care increases from about 46,000 in 2007 to close to 56,000 in 2011. And cost increases from about $1.7 billion in 2007 to $2.5 billion in 2011. The caseload increases to home and community-based waivers and home care services in the MA forecast reflect the anticipated program growth, resulting from the lifting of the disability waiver enrollment cap starting in fiscal year 2008. These caseload increases also reflect the expanded use of waiver programs to support children with severe emotional disorders and adults with mental illness. For example, 44% of people receiving CADI services, which is the waiver for people with disabilities, have a mental illness diagnosis. Another variable reflected in the anticipated caseload increase is our aging population. There's an increased need for home and community-based services that will provide 24-hour care for children of aging parent caregivers. And the programs continue to serve an aging population of people with disabilities. The chart on the right projects overall annual long-term care spending for people with disabilities to increase at a rate of 9.0% from fiscal year 2007 to 2011. It's projected that in that same period, the long-term care facility spending for people with disabilities will decline. And during that same period, Medicaid payments for waivers and home care are expected to increase at a rate of 10.6% per year. The anticipated caseload increases that I just discussed are the primary drivers of projected cost increases to home and community-based services. About 40% of the increased waiver payments are related to Minnesotans moving from institutional settings and cost shifts that capture federal financial participation from other programs, such as the state-funded group residential housing program. The increased cost of providing long-term care services is a result of factors that include the rising cost to operate programs and an increasingly competitive market for direct care workers. Since 2002, legislative changes were enacted to manage the caseload growth in the waiver programs and to help meet the state budget challenges. Specific strategies have included delaying by 6 months the allocation of new waiver resources, eliminating the forecasted growth in some of the programs, and establishing limits on the number of additional people to be served in a given period of time. Every effort has been made to ensure that these changes did not delay anticipated discharges from institutional settings. Capping the waivers results in corresponding increases in other programs, such as home care services, and leads to the creation of waiting lists for some of the waiver programs. People who are eligible and waiting for waiver services may access other programs in the meantime. Examples are Medicaid state plan benefits such as personal care services or the state-funded family support grant or the consumer support grant program. These service options can help meet a person's current service needs while the individual waits for waiver services, which will provide a more appropriate set of services. Last year, the legislature required DHS to develop a self-directed state plan service. This will be a flexible option for some people who would otherwise receive PCA services. Because those using self-directed state plan services will be able to design and direct their own services and effectively meet their needs, we expect that this option, once available, will reduce the need for some individuals to access the full menu of services through a waiver. We hope to submit a state plan proposal for this option to CMS this summer. I've included in the packet in the blue folder some information about the individuals who have been identified as waiting for one of the waivers for persons with disabilities in your folder. And Jean is doing my support here. I showed you the yellow page. County waiting list for the developmental disability waiver includes significant numbers of families with school-age children who need additional assistance and support. The waivers allow Minnesota to manage access, quality, and costs of home and community-based services. As an example, the disability waivers are managed through an aggregate average, which provides counties flexibility in serving people within an established budget. We are evaluating the services available in each waiver to ensure that people have access to the right service. In this process, we are looking at how we can respond to the needs of people who require 24-hour support with the goal of encouraging alternatives to more expensive models of residential care when another option may be available. Home and community-based services have allowed us to maintain moratoriums on more expensive institutional beds. And there is a chart, as Jean handed out, in your handout that has the Medicaid cost comparisons that illustrate the cost effectiveness of these waiver programs compared with their institutional counterparts. And in closing, the department continues to strive to work closely with the legislature, counties, service providers, advocates, health plans, families, and especially those who use services to effectively balance community expectations of improved access to needed services and additional funding flexibility with the state's needs to manage costs, assure equitable access to long-term care benefits, and account for quality of services.
If we put a cap on a waiver, but I thought that person was already eligible for, let's say, a nursing home, and then if we put the cap on the waiver program, why don't they just go to the nursing home? Where we would pay more.
Some people do, and we do see an increase there. We have a moratorium, however, on the use of intermediate care facilities or on the beds for intermediate care facilities for people with mental retardation, developmental disability. So for people, for example, who are waiting on the DD waiver, there isn't an alternative for them. So they could access other state plan services, such as PCA, or their families make do with what they can.
How about people on the elderly waiver? If we cap that, or don't we ever cap that?
We've never capped the elderly waiver.
Other questions? Well, thank you very much for your testimony, and we finished this in time. So thank you, and we may have you back. So, and I would like to remind the members to fill out your expense reimbursement sheet. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.